This is a recording made of the talk given by Rita Roscoe, author of North Manitou Island, Between Sunrise and Sunset. This is the program she gave to for the Leonore Historical Museum on Thursday, July 18th, 1991.
Thank you for asking me, and I certainly thank all of you for coming out on a very warm evening. I really didn't expect this many people. Can you hear in the back of the room?
Yep.
Turn the fans on.
The fan makes too much noise.
Chuck. Well, I'll start over again. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Well, I first want to thank Laura for asking me, and I'm certainly pleased to see so many people here. And a lot of these people that are here know more about North Manitou Island than I do. But they haven't written their book yet, so I get to come first. Evidently, no one told Laura that when I started talking about North Manitou, I never knew when to shut up. But I do have a time limit, so after a bit, if I get too long, my daughter's going to raise her hand in the back of the room and let me know I've got to cut this off. First, I guess most of you probably have either been to the island or know something about the island, but some do not. So I'd like to describe the physical island as it is. It's 12 and a half miles from Leland, that's our home port, and has been for lo these many years, and certainly the Grosvenor family has been responsible for that and has brought us everything from all the fuel that we used and hauled off the deer and hauled off the fruit and brought newborn babies home and have even taken those that passed on away. The island is 7 miles long and 4.5 miles wide. It has about every kind of terrain from open fields, meadows, swamps. We have two lakes centered in the island, Lake Manitou, which is 1.25 miles long and 3/4 mile wide. There's never been a cottage built on that island, on that particular lake. It was always decreed that that would remain open and free of occupation of residences. The terrain, as I've mentioned, goes from the potholes up on the northwest corner, which seemed to interest a lot of the more ambitious hikers, at least for the first time, and down to the low rolling beaches, and we have about 25 miles of shoreline, some of it easy to reach, some of it the high bluffs that we all find around Lake Michigan. The first people that were on the island, as far as we've found from the history so far, the prehistoric people, were there in 2000 BC, and the most recent finding would have been 1000 AD. And Dr. Cleland from Michigan State University came to the island in 1966 and did a study, and they found some interesting artifacts. Most of these findings were on the east side or the leeward side of the island, and with some findings in the dunes on the south end. There's also indications that there could have been some type of summertime occupation around the west side and also around Lake Manitou. The most interesting artifact they found was a copper awl. They found thousands of flint chips. They found hide scrapers and things of that sort. They did find at Lake Manitou what was considered to be a dugout canoe, which was probably much later date than those earlier dates we'd mentioned. Lake Michigan was opened up after the Erie Canal was opened in 1835, and that's when the shipping started, and that's when people really started coming to North Manitou. And they came there because it was a perfect spot for fueling of the steamships. The first big operation for fuels for these ships was Nicholas Picard. And we know from the records that are in existence that he was in business in 1847 with a 150-foot dock. He had a blacksmith shop, a trading post, several other buildings, and it was considered, and it was written in the 1847 survey, as being a good establishment. We know that how long it takes to build a dock on North Manitou, and certainly one of 150 feet, so we have to assume that he had to be there earlier than 1847. The ships at that time, there were 50 or more plying the lake, coming up from Buffalo to Chicago and Milwaukee and other ports along the lake. But Nicholas Picard provided work for a lot of people, and there's one spot around the old, known as the Spring, where there was a boarding house for 40 men who were wood choppers. And this was seasonal work. They would come and work through the season, and as soon as the cold weather set in and the shipping started to dwindle, then they'd head for other ports. wood sold for $2.50 a cord, and it was indicated that it wasn't cut very fine, and I can imagine it wouldn't have been because that was pretty hard work. And the men got $1 on average for cutting a cord of wood. But I guess if they worked all season and would go away with probably more money than they would have had at some other occupation for that day. By 1860, there were 269 people living on North Manitou, and it was a real community. It had started as a community in 1840s, but it was slow to grow. And by 1860, there were 269 people. They were engaged in fishing, they were farming, and of course they were in the logging and the wood chopping business. And everyone was pretty much self-sufficient. It was interesting to note from the census tract that these people came from Germany, Poland, all the Scandinavian countries, and most of them were drawn there by the fishing shoals and the promise of free land. And one interesting note I found on the opening up of this part of the country and the fact that land was available, some of those land grants were military war bounty grants from the War of 1812. When the government did not have funds to pay the soldiers, they would give them a piece of land, which the soldier never saw but would sell to a land speculator for some small amount of money. And many of those speculators never saw the land either. They simply bought it up and held tracts that would one day be sold off as land for being cut for logging, for timber interest. By 1855, I'm sure that most of you have heard of King Strang, who was on Beaver Island. And he had an influence on North Manitou Island because in 1855, because he had almost 2,000 people on Beaver Island, he was able to persuade the Michigan legislature to form a county, a separate county. And he himself named it Manitou County. And the Manitou County was in existence from 1855, and Strang died in 1856, so he only had it under his domain for 1 year. And never had much influence over it. But it stayed as Manitou County until 1895, when it finally was annexed and became part of Leelanau County. But Manitou County is one of the very few counties in the entire United States that was ever just abolished and taken off the map. That doesn't happen too often. But it did at that time join Leelanau County, and there was a lot of controversy. And those of you who've read the book will read the little excerpts that some people thought that it should be part of Leelanau County, and others thought, we don't need them, let them stay over there, they're outlaws, or they're this, or that. They simply didn't know about the people over there, and then other articles would say they were the finest hardworking group of people in the land. So I think it was probably a mixture of just like every other place, but anyway, we became part of Leelanau County. Also interesting to know that over the years, Leelanau County became the largest taxpayer in Leelanau County, and stayed in that position until the National Park Service claimed the land. And they're no longer taxed. Those who have private cottages that were still holding them in private hands would be. And by the way, there's only my cottage, which is on a lease back or in-holder situation, which I have to give up in 98. And the Carlson Hollister cottage, which they can hold forever, because it was built prior to the 1964 cutoff date. By the 1880s, farming and fruit growing, cattle raising, and the life-saving station were all growing and becoming part of island life. And the life-saving station was built in 1881, and I want to make a particular point about that building, and I do have a picture that I will show you. It's presently being used by the National Park Service to house staff, and they have remodeled it to accommodate personnel. It's the most historic building on the island, and it would be a perfect place for a public use building to either as a museum or a place to have a gathering of artifacts and photos and to put on programs and interpretive programs for the community. And I think this is important to all of you who are natives of this area. Those of you that are many that I see here tonight have family roots that go back to the earliest days on North Manitou Island, because North Manitou Island was the first settlement, North and South Manitou, long before Leland or these other nearby communities. And the reason for that was our deep water close to shore. The Grand Traverse Bay was an uncharted sea. Sailing ships were afraid to go into it for fear they would be grounded. So they were looking for a spot that had the deep water and easy access. So that's why it was south, and of course South Manitou has a lovely harbor, so that gave them an advantage in being a mecca for people that were coming to settle in this area. During the 1880s, that was the beginning of the, as I mentioned before, the life-saving station, and that's what we're interested in, is one of the buildings we would like to see saved. And I would say to those of you who have an interest in that, and I have spoken to Superintendent Miller and told him that I would be talking about that tonight, and those of you who have an interest in that building and seeing it preserved and made available for you to see, to go in and take part of, to write to them and let them know your interest in preserving this historic building. The island is interesting because it was occupied. It was not a wilderness after these people arrived and started settling and the pioneers came, and it's had occupation almost all, the whole breadth of the island. It's been cut over two or three times for logging. The most recent one ended in 1978. So it's had a very varied background of people living and farming and fishing all over the place. I also should say at this point that I have no objection to the island becoming a national park. I would rather see it a national park with everyone having a chance to see it and enjoying its unique beauty than to be perhaps held as a resort or something that was only for the select handful or a few, and also to have its natural resources exploited. My feelings about the condemnation proceedings for those of us who held property are entirely different, but we won't go into that. By the 1890s, there was a development of a resort era on the island. And some of the people here either have mothers or grandmothers or sisters or someone who had a part in those early days. Everybody seemed to have worked at the hotel, or everyone helped in building of some of these buildings, and it was an exciting period. In fact, I have mentioned in the book the Carlson family was there, the Nels Carlson family was there during the time that the life-saving service came into being and the buildings were built. They were there in 1896 when the lighthouse was built on the south end of the island, and that gave two points separated by about 3 or 4 miles of activity and economic energy for the community and social life. And from everything that I have read, there is a great deal of material about the dances, and everyone played instruments, and gatherings on Saturday night, and romances between summer visitors and young Coast Guardsmen that came there and married island girls. And it was typical of any community, only it was encapsulated in this one island area. And a lot of families are connected from those early days. But in the 1890s, the resort area began, and they built, the first cottages were built. Now, some of those cottages still remain standing. Miss Katie Shepherd's place was built about 1895. That was an 8-bedroom cottage. It's still standing. It's badly in need of some roofing to preserve it. It's typical of some of the large summer homes that were built at that time and has very interesting architecture. When I spoke with Superintendent Miller, first I spoke with him about the boathouse, which is the number one priority. Then I spoke to him about Miss Katie Shepherd's house, which is second priority. And then I casually mentioned Monte Carlo, which I think should be preserved. And by preserving it, I mean these places could be remodeled and used for the personnel of the park. It would enhance this. It would enhance the historic beauty of the island itself. These are all right in the settlement, just within sight of the dock, so that it would not intrude on the wilderness or change the wilderness concept, because I truly believe that the 27 acres that have been set aside apart from the wilderness can be enhanced with history and historic interest and not disturb one bit of enjoyment of the backpacker who just wants a wilderness experience. Because out of 15,000 acres, 27 acres is not too much to ask, or so I believe. During that resort area, the ships were made regular stops at the island. We do have some photographs of they were making regular stops between Chicago and Mackinac, so they would stop frequently at our docks. And there are pictures of ladies in the large hats and the parasols and all the nice things that went along with the lifestyle of those days. They rented cottages on the island, people that could come and stay for the summer. And they could rent a carriage and a horse and carriage or take a buggy ride up to see the Peaked Bluffs or to go fishing at Lake Manitou. But there was Later on, when Crescent was developed on the west side, which is about 5 miles from the village on the east side, I found it so strange when I talked to people that were Crescent villagers. They rarely got over to the east side, but they were putting in, the men and the husbands and fathers were putting in 10-hour days working either cutting logs of the woods or working in the sawmill, and they worked 6 days a week. And I imagine on Sunday to rent a horse and buggy and take a 5-mile trip across the island maybe didn't have that much appeal, and then have to, you know, go back and go through the same thing the next week. We've talked about some of the places that were built, and one of the most interesting houses on the island is the Bernique property, and I know there are people here that are familiar with that house. It's located near the present boat landing on the southeast side of the island. It's within walking distance of the landing. It was a 6-bedroom vertical log house. It's still standing. We would have loved to have seen that one preserved, but I don't think we have much chance on that one. But it's still interesting to see. It's still standing. It was built, as I say, of vertical logs. Some of the Anderson Oyen family, I know that I think Pete Oyen may have been involved in some of the work on that, as well as some of the other people that were had family there. Colonel Bernique, their family was from Chicago, and he was a horse fancier, and he was a dancing master in Chicago, and spent their summers there. And we're in the Monarchy room here tonight, and Monarchy was a son-in-law of Colonel Alvar Bernique, so it's kind of round and round we go here. And we're grateful to both because they left some nice things behind. The barn of the Bernique property had a dance floor on the second floor, and when they would entertain their guests, they could have dances there, and it was a nice addition to the island social life. So when people think about an isolated island and, you know, off in the distance, but there was the Coast Guard station or life-saving station, and they had a whole group of people living there. There were usually nine people on crew and their families, and most of these were married men with families. Then there was a lighthouse, which had three people, a keeper's assistant, and a third person. And then the people that were there that had farms, the private individuals that had farms scattered all over the place. So it was there was a community, and there was a lot of fun at those parties. By 1922, the Manitou Island Association, or the syndicate as it was first known, came into being. The late W.R. Angel and a group of other men had formed this syndicate and started buying up the private property. Some of the farmers had grown tired of trying to ship their produce to the mainland. It was getting more and more difficult. Shipping was becoming more expensive. And it was just more difficult to get the produce to the market and to get the things that they needed from the mainland. Some of them were willing sellers because they were ready to give up. Others hung on and refused to sell. One notable exception was the Molesky family. I see Paul is here tonight. And they held out and did not sell till, I believe, 1958. And there were often offers made to the Molesky family, but their roots ran back to the island to about 1868, when the first Molesky came to the island, and they actually settled and began family there in 1875. And the Moleskys did give up easily. We do have some photographs here tonight that we can show. We don't have a projector and pictures, but we can show these, pass them around. But anyway, the syndicate started in 1922, and it was through that group that they introduced deer to the island. And the first group of deer they brought in, there were 9 deer. The island had been used prior to that for cattle raising, and the cattle ran free and they were herded by dogs. Well, the dogs took after the deer, and the deer didn't act the same as the cattle had reacted, so 2 of the bucks were killed on the first day that they were released. But out of the 9, there were the surviving bucks and does made up the herd that at one time reached a figure of about 2,000. The deer weren't hunted. It was not started as a hunting lodge until 1937. That was the first year. So the deer came in about 1925, and it was not until 1937. But they had miscalculated how quickly this herd would grow. And there was also miscalculations after that as to how many they should take each year. So the island became over-browsed years ago. It was almost park-like, that you could look through the woods, and it was open and just like a city park. because there were too many deer. The deer were fed in the wintertime. It was a big business operation. In time, Mr. Angel bought out the other men and the syndicate until just he and his partner, Roger Sherman, were the two owners of the island at the time that I first became familiar with it in 1942. And in time, Mr. Sherman sold his interest to Mr. Angel, and Mr. Angel became the sole owner of the island. The deer hunting was done on a very selective basis. They sold contracts to corporations, notably Connell Motors Corporation, which W.R. Angel at one time had been president of that corporation. But we dealt with other companies too, and we would contract for so many people at a set price for a doe or a buck. And it was a good business operation. This continued up until, I believe the last hunt was 1978. And this, as I say, began in 1937. The last year that they hunted, they took off over 500 deer. On average, the years before that, they were taking off around 3 to 350 a year, but it was not sufficient to control the herd. I wanted to say something else about that period of time and the operation for the deer hunt. It was not like a typical hunting experience. There were linen cloths on the table for dinner. Everything was under control. The men were taken out to their hunting stations in station wagons or other vehicles that were available. They came in for lunch. They were limited. If they chose to have a drink, they may have two drinks. If they took more than two drinks, they were restricted. They could not go back in the woods for the afternoon. They would go back in the woods for the afternoon hunt, then they came back and had a couple of drinks before dinner, and then after dinner they could do as they chose because they weren't going back in the hunt till morning. They were gentlemen hunters for the most part, and it was a very nice operation, and it was a profitable operation during that time. By 1932, and we talked earlier about the lighthouse and the Coast Guard station being the economic development of the island. Well, every one of us, and I see many people here my age, who remember what was happening in 1932 and 33. It was the aftermath of the Depression. The government was cutting back on many things. So they'd ordered the closing of the lighthouse first in 32, and then in 1933, the Coast Guard station. And this was a real blow to the island. The school went down from having from 15 to 20 students to the Molesky children were still there, and one or two others, and that was it. Because when those people, that took the social life, it took the economic base, and it left the Manitou Island Association pretty much in charge, and it became like a company town, because they owned about 95 to 96% of the island. There were just four or five private cottages, and everyone that lived there, or those few handful of people that had cottages that came in the summertime. It was changing. And it was in 1942 that I came to the island, and many people ask when meeting me for the first time, how did you get there and where did you come from? Well, I'm originally from Texas, from Fort Worth, and my husband Jack Hadder was from Dallas. I came to the island in 1942 when I was 21, and my husband was 20 years older than I. We'd been traveling with an auditing company. We'd been married a year, and we'd been traveling a year with an auditing company all throughout the Southwest. And in Detroit, we were on our way to New York because in 1942, it was very hard to keep an auditing crew together. Everyone was going in service. So we were on our way to the home office in New York City, and I could hardly wait to get there because at that time, I was not interested in the great outdoors. I liked department stores and clothes and all the things, the bright lights. And I was on my way to New York, and it was really the Big Apple then. I mean, it was a great and wonderful place to be. Well, while we were in Detroit, Jack met Mr. Angel through a business connection. And Mr. Angel was looking for a business manager for the Manitou Island Association. And he came home and started telling me about this. He had met with him several times. I was totally not interested. I didn't want to hear about it. I knew nothing about Northern Michigan. But we talked about it. Mr. Angel invited me to have lunch with he and Jack had lunch together. And we discussed it more. And I was uneasy all during this luncheon because I thought, we're taking up this man's time. We have no interest in going to that island. Why don't we say thank you and leave? And to this day, I don't know why. But two weeks, of course, I will say W.R. Angel, when he talked about North Manitou Island, was a world-class spellbinder. He loved the place. He was a terrific salesman. He was dominating personality. 2 weeks after that luncheon, we had decided to go to the island, sight unseen, with a 2-year commitment. And then it found out that it was necessary for me to go ahead of Jack because the postal inspector was going to be there to swear me in as postmaster, because the postmaster was leaving. Her husband had already gone downstate, and I would have to be there to be sworn in. So Jack brought me to Leland, and I spent the night at what was then the Nicholas Hotel, and he returned immediately to Detroit because he was still working for the auditing company and had to finalize plans. The next morning, I was up bright and early and went down to find Tracy Grosvenor and found out the boat wasn't going to be going to the island until very late that day. So by the time I fooled around in Leland all day, and there wasn't much in Leland then, there were no shops. You could get a soda at Leland Merck. And of course, there was the Bluebird little tea room type thing at that time. So that night before dark, we set out. I was the only passenger on board the old Manitou. And on the way over, Tracy, I was full of questions, but I was very shy when I was 21, which is hard for you to believe, but I was. And on the way over, I kept asking Tracy questions. And I'm sure he thought, where is she from, and how could she not know if she's going there, you know, but he was tolerant. We got there, it was almost dark, and there were no lights on the dock, a little tiny dock. And up in the distance, I could see a few dim lights. Well, they picked me up, they took me up to the lodge. I found out I was the only guest in the lodge, and the postal inspector was not there. He had been called to do something else, and he wouldn't be there for several days. So I had dinner and went upstairs to a bedroom, and Mrs. McClary was the lodge operator, and I could tell she had been packing and preparing to leave, and she was very tired and worn out, so I thought, well, I'll go to bed and read. Well, I had hardly begun to read when the lights flickered, and then they were turned off totally. And I kept waiting for them to come back, but they didn't. So the next morning, I came down, and Mrs. McClary took one look at me, and I could tell from her expression that she was amused by my appearance, because we had made our decision to go to the island so quickly, we had not given one thought about what you wear on an island. I mean, we were accustomed to, Jack was in business suits, and I was in suits and high heels and silky stockings and things of that sort. So when I came down for breakfast that next morning, she looked at me and smiled, and then I didn't quite realize that I was totally inappropriate, but we just hadn't thought about clothes. But our first order out to Sears and Montgomery Ward was to get some low-heel shoes and some washable things that we could wear on the island. But the postal inspector didn't come for several days. But that was my 49th anniversary was July the 3rd. That was the my arrival on the island in 1942. So anyway, that started our beginnings on North Manitou. That's how I came there, a girl from Texas. And some of the people that were here may have been among some of those who were taking bets on how long we were going to stay there. And I wouldn't have bet that I would stay either, because I couldn't get over the silence. It was totally silent. After you've lived in cities and hotels and travel and every meal in restaurants and, you know, you're bopping about all the time, I just could not believe how quiet it could be, how silent it was. And then the day that Jack arrived and I met him at the boat, and we met the people that, you know, everybody was down to meet the boat. That's still what they do today if the boat comes in close enough, huh, George? But and of course, he was eager to find out how I was faring on the island by myself, and I had so much to tell him about the light system and why the lights didn't come on. But when they flickered the lights, that was the signal that it's going to go off, and you were supposed to light a kerosene lamp, but no one had told me that. So I asked then, well, what is the routine for this electric system? And Mrs. McClary said, well, the man that runs the system, whenever he's ready to go to bed. So you had to pay attention to that flicker and get your... I finally learned, before we got the big diesel plants in over there to provide electricity, I learned to light a lamp early. I guess that's true, that you keep your lamps ready to light. Keep your lamps ready. But anyway, that was the beginning. Another thing that I found interesting in living there was that our telephone system was one of the wooden ones on the wall with the crank. We didn't have a number. We had three rings. We were also connected with the crib, South Manitou, and then it ran over to Maple City. Sometimes it was shifted through Cedar or somewhere else, but Maple City most often. And because the guys on the crib were lonely and the people on the, at the Coast Guard station on South Manitou were lonely and those of us on North Manitou were interested in whatever was going on, you never had a private conversation. So that many times when I'd have to call Leland Merck to add to my grocery order and I would, you know, tell them what I needed and sometimes they couldn't hear me because there were so many phones off the hook. But often one of the Coast Guardsmen or one of the fellas on the crib would say, "She said two heads of lettuce." So we made do. And now we're back to that. Some gentleman here said he hears me on the radio. Our call letters on our marine radio now are the Gina O. And I said, "You hear some interesting things at times." But we're trying to make things work. As I've mentioned to you, some of the different eras of the island, each one of them, we could talk all evening about any one segment. But the island has had a varied history. It's gone from being a wilderness to a thriving community, to having all of these different centers of activity, to a well-knit place where everyone was acquainted and in many cases related to their neighbors. And then after 1932-33, it became this company town. And then it was only the number of people that we could keep employed that were willing to live and work on an island.